This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Happy New Year to all my listeners. We are starting 2024 off with a bang, just as we ended last year. You just heard the song American Town from the legendary Cape Cod hardcore punkers, The Freeze. And today, we are joined by Cliffhanger and Bill Close from The Freeze in a very special interview. Check out this message from Joe's Albums, and we will be right back. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums and their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. It's 2024? Really? Where did the last 4 years go? I don't know, man. I don't know. Boston has always been a hard-nosed, tough town in many ways, and the music scene is certainly no exception. The landscape has changed a bit from the way it was in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s. It was a very incestuous scene and wasn't always kind to outsiders. If you weren't from the 617 area code, there was skepticism. That's not to say that some bands didn't move to Boston and succeed. Throwing Muses comes to mind, although they were a New England band coming from Newport, Rhode Island. The Red Rockers seemed to fit in when they located to Boston from New Orleans. And then there's all the kids that went to school in Boston, whether it be Harvard University across the river in Cambridge, or we had Corey Lou Brennan on, and he explained a lot of that to us in reference to Bullet LaVolta and the Lemonheads. You had Boston College, BU, MIT. There's a long list of replants that come here, and a lot of them are musicians. Berklee School of Music is probably, of course, where most of the outsiders showed up and ended up in the scene. Some came to Boston, attended Berklee, dropped out, and became famous in the scene anyways. Amy Mann comes to mind. Rick Ocasek and Ben Orr moved to Boston in the 70s and became even bigger rock stars. And we have to mention Steven Tyler. He relocated to Boston from New York and ended up forming what very well may be the most famous band ever to come from Boston, Aerosmith. Sometimes it can even be tough coming from the suburbs or even Cape Cod, which even though it's located in Massachusetts, it can seem like a different world compared to Boston. All right, hang on. We'll be right back. Attention guitar players. I know you're out there. I have some exciting news for you. You ready? Put down that six string and listen. Stomp Underfoot are handmade guitar pedals by fuzz-obsessed Matt Pascarella. Matt makes every pedal using quality, new, old stock, obsolete, and rare through hole components. I know you know what that means if you're a guitar player, right? Every pedal is also entirely hand-wired, tested, and ready to go. If you want high-quality handmade pedals, check out Stomp Underfoot at stompunderfoot.com. Okay, speaking of Cape Cod, the Freeze, despite being pretty damn good at writing and playing punk songs, were not exactly greeted with open arms when they started playing in Boston. They actually had a target on their backs, and we hear some stories about that in our talk with Cliff and Bill, and some of them aren't really that nice, but it happened. The early Boston hardcore scene was run by the Boston Crew, and despite what we have heard from some of our guests, with all due respect, they were intimidating to teenagers, or even some of us in our early 20s. I mean, I felt intimidated by them, and I'm sure other people did. Still, regardless of the friction, the Freeze became one of the best bands to emerge from the Boston hardcore scene. Their appearance on This Is Boston, Not LA is historic. Their album, Land of the Lost, is clearly one of the best records to come from that era. Embraced by their peers or not, you can't deny they were right there with SSD, DYS, FUs, Jerry's Kids, and Gangrene as an intricate part of the original Boston hardcore scene. Today, we get to hear their story. Here I am, I'm talking with Cliff Hanger and Bill Close. Enjoy. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. All right, please welcome to the show Cliff Hanger and Bill Close from The Freeze. Hello, hey. Gentlemen.
Good morning. Or is it?
Yeah, so you're in Arizona right now, right, Cliff?
I am. And I'm actually happy to say it's cold outside.
Do you live in Phoenix by any chance?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to live on 7th Avenue in McDowell.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, how long ago was that?
That was in the 2007-08. I was there for 2 years.
Well, that's right around when we moved out here.
Cliff. Yeah, I actually liked it.
I didn't know they let you. I'm sorry, what? Guys. I didn't know they let you have that much artwork in your cell.
These guys are admiring their backgrounds. I see some vinyl back there. That's the first thing I ever see is vinyl, you know?
Sorry,
didn't what, over to... here? None of that's mine. Yeah, you did.
No, that was Steve's show, okay?
Bill,
no, this you're... is the Bill Close show.
Okay. And Bill, you're on the West Coast now, right?
Yeah. I'm in like...
Not right now.
No, I'm in Boston right now. But I live like in North Hollywood, Burbank.
Oh, I lived in
Studio City.
I like
to call
City.
It Burbank adjacent.
Yeah, I lived in Studio City too, you know.
Yeah, so. I lived in Studio City right behind Sportsman's Lodge.
I was Coldwater and Moore Park.
Yeah, I lived in that neighborhood.
Yeah, it's a good neighborhood.
Going towards Ventura off from Moore Park down Coldwater, first left on the right.
But we're all born in... We're all born in Massachusetts, though, right?
Correct, baby.
Correct. But Steve, did you ever live in Yarmouthport?
No, I never lived on the Cape.
Okay, well, there you go. So that's it. I'm out now. I'm through. I quit.
You know what? We're going to talk about the Cape right now, actually. I was going to ask you guys to start things off, and either one of you can go first. What was it like growing up on the Cape?
I didn't start out on the Cape. I started out up in closer to Boston. But Cliff, born and raised.
Yeah, I've actually begun the book. And I've begun assembling the cast of characters that, you know, came from the Cape. And my God, what a bunch of personalities we had down there. A bunch of characters.
Yeah.
I mean, you get Rick Andrews and Paul Ferguson, Doug Carey, the way he came from, you know, Doug Carey, the first band manager. I don't know where he is right now or if he's okay, but most people aren't at this point that came from back there. But I mean, he was sent to our high school from Exeter College, you know, real high, you know, high tier, top tier preppy college. I mean, grade school for making bombs or something, you know, he got kicked out of his prep school, and he comes down to Cape Cod, and you know, me and him, you know, just naturally hook up. He starts managing the band. He comes up with a line: "I hate tourists. Tourists suck. It's only the daughters I want to fuck." And then, you know, I didn't write that. Actually, Doug Carey did. That's
really?
Why you see his name get. Yeah, he. That's why you see his name get. He gets credit on that. You know, writing credit on that song. But and then he had us write a song around that. And if he hadn't have written that couplet, that we probably never would have made it off the Cape, because that's what caught WBCN's ear, and they played it every day during their lunch hour novelties kind of song time, you know, in the summer.
Did you feel like living out there that you were kind of removed from the rest of the world?
Yeah, but I liked it though too. Especially when it came, you know, and it came to like with the band, you know, we weren't directly taking from anybody, you know, we didn't have other people like really forcing us to be a certain way or even nudging us in a certain direction, you know, and that kind of left it to us to come up with our own thing, you know, which I think we did, you know, we came kind of in between the original, came out kind of in between the original punk scene in Boston, you know, that kind of thing. And the hardcore thing, you know, we were in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, kind of in what, 1970, we started in 78, but we didn't get going to 1980. And by that time, and hardcore hadn't really come out yet, you know, and we kind of like started at the same time as the Dead Kennedys, I think.
Yeah. I'm going to definitely talk to you about that, because you guys were you know, pioneers as far as I'm concerned in the whole thing. Bill, you said you grew up near Boston, but you moved to the Cape.
Yeah, I grew up in East Dedham, which is next to Hyde Park, like 10 miles out of town, you know. So the older kids in the school, we had like a dead end street in a schoolyard that our little gang of like all the kids in the neighborhood, young and old, hung out. So the older kids were going into the Rat and stuff. You know, prior to that, it was like Black Sabbath concerts and things. But then when punk happened, those guys were going to the Rat and stuff. I think the drinking age was 18. So they were bringing back the singles and stuff that they used to sell at the Rat. And I think it was the What was her name? That Barb from Thrills, I think,
Oh,
sold
yeah.
singles down there. So I got the first damn singles and the Dead Boys and stuff handed to me from an older kid in like 1978 or something. I was just a kid, you know, and I just, all my Kiss records went out the window, started listening to punk rock. I have Pistols and Clash on 8-track, still have them. Anyways, my parents got divorced. I moved to the Cape. I bumped into Cliff when I was about 13 years old at the Record Bin and the Music Smith in the mall. And I was looking for the, I think I was trying to get the Ramones It's Alive import. I think they might have had it there, but remember when we bumped into each other and I was going through, you're like, who's this little kid into punk rock or something, you know?
I thought that was on, I kind of remember that, but I thought even before that was when you were calling the WKKL.
Oh yeah, the radio
DJ.
Street. Yeah.
Yeah. I had like a you know, a punky kind of like radio station. I mean, radio show up on the Cape Cod Community College radio station, and I remember it was, you know, the only person I would get calls from would be this kid. He'd call in and he'd call in every show and he'd be like, "Hey man, could you play you know, the Damned?" And I'd be like, "What? You know the Damned?" Because no one on the Cape knew any bands like the Damned, or "Play some Eddie and the Hot Rods." I go, "You know Eddie and the Hot Rods?" He goes, "Yeah, why wouldn't I?" He's getting all flippant and stuff, you know. I didn't know him at the time. I go, "How old are you?" He goes, 11.
Well, I don't know if I was 11. I mean, I might have been 12.
He was 79. How old were you?
Yeah, like 12, 13, 12, 13, maybe 7.
Okay.
But Cliff would be on the radio and he'd go, "Remember the night?" I remember it. And he'd be like, "This is the new Bloys to Cult release," or something. And it would be like, "Do, do, 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 do,
That's so for as Cliff, long as it lasted. Yeah, it didn't last too long.
Did you start with classic rock also, Cliff, before you got into the punk stuff?
Well, there was no such thing as punk stuff when I first got into music. So, yeah, yeah. I'm 60. I'm 62 now. I don't know how old you are, but same age.
Yeah, older, believe it or not. And I'm not supposed to tell people that on the radio, on my show, but I did. Thanks a lot for
oh,
that.
Oh yeah.
So you were listening to like what made you discover punk music? I mean, do you remember what it was, what you heard?
Oh yeah, I remember the exact moment that it happened. It was it was 70. I mean, it was 77, and we were listening to you know, the usual. my parents just made the big mistake of buying me Black Sabbath's "We Sold Our Soul for Rock and Roll," that double album, the best of, on Christmas morning. You know, this time of year. And you know, I go upstairs. We're not a religious family and stuff, but you know, my parents kind of are respectful of it and all that kind of thing. And I went upstairs and I just cranked it for like, you know, the entire Christmas morning. Till my father went, "Get the goddamn thing! Will you turn the goddamn music down?" And I said, "Yes, yeah, sure." "Oh, what?" And I turn it back up again. I'm sorry, Dad, I can't hear you. You know, until finally, like Christmas morning, comes in and breaks the record for Army. But I mean, it was that kind of stuff. And then, like, I got into you know, Alice Cooper. You know, the usual litany, I suppose. Probably, Alice Cooper was a big favorite of mine. Led Zeppelin, you know, even Kiss. Back, I was a little. I thought I was a little old for Kiss until I heard some of their earlier numbers. I think "Going Blind" is my favorite song by Kiss. Still,
but were that's you, a musical number.
Were you interested in playing at that time, Cliff, or were you just more of a fan?
My father always played, but you know, I'd gotten my dose of you know, early for 50s rock and country stuff in, you know, through my father's playing and stuff. And yeah, I always wished I could play. But then I remember, like, I was listening to a WKKL, the, you know, the community college radio station one time. And it was probably 78, early 78. And we'd heard about punk, you know, read about it in Cream magazine and stuff like this. But, you know, the stuff Johnny Rotten was doing or whatever, they'd have the little blurbs on it. And, you know, I'd always wanted to get something like that because I was already into, you know, Abbie Hoffman and the counterculture 60s stuff, you know, the the activist people, not the ones that sat around. Like Abbie Hoffman used to say, like, you know, a yippie, which is what kind of like the activist kind of hippies were basically the hippies that were hit over the head with a cop's club and, you know, and therefore, like, you know, get up off the ground and, you know, started doing something about it. You know, and I was thinking, that's there it is. Now, what can I do? And there was nothing to do. You know, there was, like, you know, not, you know, not any, the movements were old and they were dying out. The counterculture people were all fugitives from justice or something. They're all in Argentina or they're mysteriously dying, you know, like Abbie Hoffman gets hit by a car, supposedly, or whatever. He ODs on barbiturates. And his own lawyer told me one time that, like, he had 600 or something barbiturates in his stomach. And there's no way if anyone would know how to kill themselves on drugs, it would be Abbie Hoffman. And he was saying he can just picture, like, this is William Kunstler talking, the guy that represented Abbie in the trial. And he's telling me this at a book signing. He's saying, like, yeah, I can just picture Abbie being strapped down and being force fed fistfuls of pills by the CIA, you know, contract agents or something they had. And he goes, no way did that happen. Like it's the media says it happened. But anyway, I've had to find something to help me rebel against something, you know.
That's interesting. I was going to say, I heard Abbie Hoffman speak in Worcester when I was really young. It was mind blowing. Yeah, I did. I'm also a fan of that whole scene right there that you're talking about. It's get out there and protest, man, if you need to protest. I forget what song you have, but you have a song that you talk about how they help keep the protesters back. You know, they don't want you to protest. The cops will beat you up or whatever. I know. Well, I heard that.
A couple of them are like that. Yeah. I mean, too blind to see, I think, is like that. And then Disney Died Smiling on the latest one there is like that. But yeah, it's a recurring theme anyway, you know, being, you know, held back and held down, you know, under the big foot of Big Brother.
Before we bring Bill in from when he came down, how did you form the band? I mean, did you found...
I've talked all around it, but not at it. But what happened was Rob Rosenthal, who ended up being DeCradle, and I were listening to the WKKL. And we heard the DJ, somebody we knew. So we're going to play something new here because you had to play something out of these certain bins, you know, at a certain time. And, well, okay, this is when I have to play something new. This band is, I don't know what it is. I don't know. It's called the Ramones. And the song's called Teenage Lobotomy. And, you know, all of a sudden we heard that, we heard the beat and it was just like, there it is, there it is. And Rob and I looked at each other and said, we can play that. Let's go. And so we went over to Music Smith and, like Bill was saying, the cutout bin area, and we'd buy everything that looked remotely punk. And I remember the first time we came out of there with, like, you know, first three Ramones albums. They were all in the cutout bin too. The first Saints, the Young, Loud, the Snotty, you know, we came out of there with, like, the first two Stranglers. We came out of there with everything. Tough Darts, remember them?
Yeah.
She's Dead, you know, the kind of, just, you know, everything. We spent like $200 each and stuff, and we cleaned it out. And then we go over there every couple of weeks and we buy everything new that could be until we learned about Newbery Comics and this kind of thing. We used to take Shrek to Boston, but anyway, and then we just started the band after hearing Teenage Lobotomy from the Ramones. So we could do that.
What was the original? Who were the original guys that you started playing with?
Well, Rob and I started the band, and let's see. So then there was Kevin Vichet, who came in before Lou Cataldo on drums. We just happened on the Cape too. We just happened to find the only people that were into punk happened to play different instruments or agreed to try to, you know. And so Rick Andrews was the one on bass. He was the one guy that we got that actually could play when we got him in there. And that's why, like, if you listen to the first single, the bass is all over the place. He's playing. He actually knows what he's doing. He's jazz taught. His father was a jazz player on bass. And yeah, he knows what he's doing. And the rest of us are just like, you know, we got a four note synthesizer thing going on Don't Forget Me, Tommy. And it's probably the worst produced thing I've ever heard in my life, but it, you know, it did what it had to do. You know, it is what it is, and you know, I'm proud of it. You know,
do you remember your Do you remember when you first started doing gigs? I mean, did you play out in the Cape before you must have played out there first, right?
Yeah, well, we had luckily, well, Lou joined right after the Lou Cataldo on drums. He joined right after the single came out, because and Kevin Vichet, that drummer, left and went to vet school, and anyways, Lou's brother Steve, you know, the Nervous Eaters.
Yes.
Yeah, he got he the Nervous Eaters had a couple shows. They were playing on the Cape and stuff, parties and stuff, and you know, we play with them, and you know,
Wow.
Steve was always you know, helpful, you know, with us. And then we got a show at the Mill Hill Club. I mean, I finally get into playing there. I somehow managed to, I can't remember exactly because I was drinking back then, but somehow we managed to talk the manager of the club into like letting us have a show or two there. And that just like snowballed into like we could have an afternoon to have anyone we wanted there, you know. And yeah, with Nervous Eaters, we're always like, you know, kind enough to play, and they helped us out. Steve did a lot. Yeah, so
In
we played a
this,
few shows around the Cape, and then we went to Boston, basically.
do you recall the early Boston shows? I mean, was it with any of the other bigger bands from that era, like, Gangrene, Jerry's Kids, or were you before all of those bands? Because you guys were pretty much the
No,
first.
we were before them, but the first show we played with was with a, I forget the name of the band, but it was at the Rat, and but one of the first shows we played up there was with the Outlets,
Oh,
and
nice.
I'll always remember that. And you know, as that's when we met Walter, and I remember like I was with Lou, you know, and drummers kind of like they like to, you know, talk, and so I remember seeing this guy walk up to us, big guy, leather jacket, and we knew what we'd heard the Outlets before, and he walks up to me and Lou, he goes, anybody can for a drink. He's got a briefcase, and he goes, "Martini?" And yeah, sure. And he goes, "Oh, I'm Walter. I'm with the Outlets." He opens up his briefcase and stuff, and he's got the whole setup going. He starts pouring this and that, and we're just sitting there getting shit faced before the first set list, and before the set. And anyway, we hit it off right away, you know. And just shout out to Walter. If he I haven't heard from you in a long time, Walter. Love to talk to you again. But I don't know if anyone knows how he's doing. But anyway, that was my first shining moment in Boston. And then we'd play with you know, we play with Lou Miami and the Cosmetics. We play with Human Sexual Response. We play with, you know, these bands too. We also get down to the Mill Hill Club. Basically, na we name it actually in the Nervous Eaters. And then I believe, if memory serves me right, which usually doesn't. Which is why I'm writing a book, and it's going to be called A Fictional Autobiography, because I can't remember what's what. But I think we gave Gangrene their first show, didn't their first live show? Didn't they play their first party a night before, and then they came down to the Cape for a show?
I
Was it
know
their first
Master
live
D
one?
Control second show or something, It was
Yeah,
all at the very beginning,
yeah, yeah. And we'd been around for a year or two at that time, so.
Okay, so is this after the single came out?
Yeah.
Okay, so you put I Hate Tourists, Don't Forget Me Tommy single on Rebel Records. Was that like your own label?
Yeah. That was Doug Carey. The guy I told you who was making the bombs. He was co-manager, and yeah, he was making money. He had enough extra cash from selling acid and mescaline and shit around from to kids in high school. I mean, he was still in high school too, so
But
you know,
even
that
prior
helped.
to Boston, not LA. It was the Wicked Good Time thing, right?
Oh, the American
Wicked Good
Town,
Time
yeah,
Volume
version.
1 or 2.
Yeah,
Volume
Volume
two.
2, but
And you guys
yeah,
did
with
the
American
Rumble
Town.
too.
Oh yeah, we did the Rumble. Yeah, I remember like the review of that. We sounded some shitty, but the review of it was yeah, the Freeze brought the Rat element back to the Rumble. It was nice to see, you know. So yeah, we kind of like acted that out. We knew we sucked, so we just went along with it, you
I
know. But
actually, the first time I heard the band, I was doing college radio. It was 1981. American Town was on a Wicked Good
yeah.
Time Volume 2. And I was like, who the hell is this band? And you guys sounded amazing. Now,
That's
you
the
could.
lineup.
Yeah,
That's like what I consider the real lineup. That was, if it could have stayed like that, who knows, Cliff? Who knows?
Were you already part of the band at that
no,
time?
No, I was hanging around. I was, you know, I would go to their rehearsals and stuff and saw them at the high school, at Dennis Yarmouth High School, like real
oh,
early
that's right.
on. I would go over to the original drummer's house where they rehearsed, like way back in the early days. But so I was kind of always had a foot in it a little bit, just like keeping my finger on the pulse because it was the only thing in town, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking at the dates here, and it was like about a year after that that you actually came. Now, I wanted to ask you, Cliff, you know, this is Boston, not LA, one of the most iconic records ever, and you guys have a heavy stamp on that. How did you get on Newbery Comics and Modern Methods? How did they find you guys? How did they hear about you? Did they see you at a show or something?
I think it has to do with "I Hate Tourists" being played by BCN. You know that made the Boston Phoenix's top 10 singles of the year.
Wow!
And yeah, you know, it's been pretty good for like, you know, a bunch of bratty Cape Cod kids. You know, all of a sudden to be noticed by some of the, you know, the bigger indie people up in Boston. I mean, it was a compliment, you know. But,
was that on Oedipus's show that was getting played?
I'm not sure who it was. Whoever had, I guess it did. It did at some point. But whoever had the noontime shows.
Oh, you guys could play during the day.
Yeah, during the day, it was a novelty thing. They played it every day that entire summer, you know, at noontime. You know, when people were driving around and, you know, road rage was happening, they could at least, you know, sit back and laugh about something. But
I can understand how someone at the Cape would write a song, "I Hate Tourists." I mean, it's just, they invaded your town, man. You know, I was one of them. I would try and drive straight all the way to Provincetown, but, you know, I didn't always make it that far, you know?
Oh, well, you know, the same thing. We didn't care about the tourist thing. It just, as long as, you know, the only thing that we didn't like, it was just trying to get off the Cape in the summertime, you know, like it took 3 hours to get off the Cape to go do something, like go play a show up in Boston or something. You get stuck at the Cape Cod Canal for
yeah.
3 hours and people would all be out of this, getting out of their car, like, you know, looking, what the hell's going on up here? And all these rednecks and stuff, and just, you know, whatever.
I know you guys did a lot of recording with Steve. Steve didn't do the tracks on "This Is Boston, LA," though, did he?
No, he didn't.
Talk about that.
About what? About Steve?
No, "This Is Boston, Not LA," the recording process and all that.
We'll see. Let's "Broken Bones." I don't know if you know. It just has a different sound than the other ones.
Yeah,
because that was recorded prior to Boston, Not LA. Those songs, at the same session as the American Town version. You know, the came out, was it 81, I think.
Yes,
on that Wicked Good Time Volume 2. And at that session, we recorded that American Town, Refrigerator Heaven, that ended up on the Unsafe at Any Speed EP, which
yeah.
is called Boston, LA. Broken Bones, and the version of Trouble If You Hide that didn't see light of day until what was it, like Token Bones or something. I don't know, I forget what that's on. But anyway, yeah, we did four songs prior to that. And so Broken Bones we had already, and that's why it let off the segment there and kind of set the tone. And then the rest of the stuff, we it'd been new songs that Rob and I had been writing, you know. I remember I wrote "Time Bomb" in Boston, Not LA on open tune Hondo guitar, and my job as assistant manager at a record store on the Cape Cod, you know, and I just, nobody would come in when I was there because I was always playing punk music and nobody liked it, but the managers didn't know it, so they were just wondering why the draw was so short all the time. But anyway, yeah, I just wrote it sitting there. I played open tune guitar and I mean, basically, that's how those songs came together. Rob had a few, but Rob was starting to drift away. Rob was more into the, like, we like to call each other, like, you know, I was the dead boy side of the band, of the punk band, you know, band, and Rob was the jam side of it. And it kind of, it worked out well for a while, but then Rob decided he had enough of it, and he went to school he became a pretty successful DJ, I think. I tell you,
Now,
it's a pleasure.
there's a lot of speculation on the song, "This is Boston, not LA." Now, I understand you didn't really write that dissing on LA. You just was it because you just felt Boston's scene deserved the attention?
It wasn't even, it was just basically like seeing for the first time what a scene was like. We like I say, we were alone. And there were good and bad parts of a scene. People think that I've noticed that, so what the song sucked, but so what, they're from, and just fill in the blanks. And it's like, a band's not good just because they're from a certain geographical location. They're good, they're good or they're not good. It's like it doesn't matter where they're from. But these people would all get props for being from a certain city, or no, they're from Chicago, so they had to be fucking good. No, they didn't have to be. I'm sorry. It's like, it's good. Say we suck, I don't care. But just because, I just it was I saw the same thing happening in Boston, and I just hoped it wouldn't, that the bands would just not look to each, just look inside to be what they are, just bring out what they feel and not what they see, to as for their identity, that kind of thing as a band. And yeah, it had nothing to do with LA was just a hot spot and still is too. But
Did you feel any backlash from the LA bands when that
we
came out?
were,
Because everybody got to know that record.
I know they did, yeah. And I gotta admit, people ask me what, about that all the time. I remember I got a message from Metal Mike from the Angry Samoans a while back, going, "Hey, we had some really good bands out here too." I go, "Yeah, Mike, I know, but I know that's exactly that's the thing. You guys have the great bands out there, and we just didn't want to see just replicas, of that kind of thing happening out here." That's all. It's more of an ode to, than anything else. And I remember having to explain that to Rick Agnew and a few other people too. But you're right though, because everybody does know that. It was a great marketing ploy by Modern Method to make it seem like it was one scene against the other or something,
Well, they
to
call
that
the
kind of thing.
record "This is Boston, not LA," and that's basically what, because I moved to LA at the end of 83, and I remember that people used to ask me about that, like, why do the Boston bands hate us? I'm like, I don't really think they hate you, man. I think it's just
No,
a
not at all. It's not at all. It's again, it's more like, because they were so dominant and so influential and stuff, it's like it would be hard to not, like, look over to that scene as you're forming your own, and then hopefully not become just a shadow of rather than who you really are,
Yeah, I mean, they were
that's all. It's just,
copying the look and everything, wearing the
yeah.
same uniform, the
Which
stuff
is, yeah, which is,
magazines.
and that's, and that was, again, why, like, a lot of the reason why, like, we got into punk to begin with was, not wearing the uniform and stuff, but the uniform just switched from suit and tie to, like, Doc Martens and leather jacket or something, but, which I can say, I can't say I was immune to, but I don't own the leather jacket anymore. I might own a pair of Doc Martens, but that's not the point either, though. The point is just to be who you are. If that's who you are, that's cool. But
You can understand how people would have misinterpreted that, though, right?
oh, absolutely. I mean,
Yeah.
that's exactly, that was part of Modern Method's goal, was to have that happen that way. It was a good marketing ploy, but on their part, it got a lot of attention from a lot of places that wouldn't have had they not, riled up some feathers, but
Now, Bill, Guilt Face, was that the first record you played on?
yeah, that was Guilty Face. That was
Guilty Face, sorry.
and I had the honor and privilege of this Rick Andrews still being around, because I was still a young guy. I was 14, like 15, 14, I don't know. And Rick knew how to play. That no one was ever able to fill his shoes, he was like a real musician that brought really interesting an angle to the early Freeze stuff that, made the band sound really cool. Yeah, that was right after, I think, Rob went to Hartford or something, to college. And so it was me, Lou, Steve, I mean, me, Lou, Cliff, and Rob. No, me, Rick, Lou, me, Rick, Lou, four piece, right? I was the only guitar player. And that was with Jimmy Dufour and those guys over at Radio Beat, who are, they knew how to record the stuff, you know, the 8-track tape. And yeah, that was the first one. I remember Chris Doherty came in to visit and stuff. It was in Kenmore Square, you know. So everybody was kind of, you know, supportive of each other back then too. Yeah, it was cool. It was
You know,
great.
I've talked to, like, Chris several times, and Glenn, he came in later on, and all the Jerry's Kids guys and SSD. You know, Al's been on the show, Jamie, Chris, and I talked to John Anastas, and I got to tell you, all of those bands, when I asked them about the scene, they all mentioned the Freeze. They respected you guys. Did you feel that respect coming to you when you used to play the shows in Boston at that time?
Yeah, to a certain point, but then there was a fallout that happened that kind of divided, you know, us against them or them against us or whatever. And I think Cliff, you might have been at the spearhead of that with the
If
when
I
that
rem if I rem
SSD.
if I remember correctly, it was when Forced Exposure came out, and that first issue they basically had their editorial section, like big pro SSD control and big anti-freeze section in the editorial part. And I remember, like, I forget who it was, but somebody from the magazine, Zine, was coming around looking for bands to take out ads in it. And they had come up to us at one of our shows that we were playing, one of those shows where we might have just barely made enough money to get back to the Cape from Boston, one of those $30 payouts. And they're asking, we honestly didn't have the money, we didn't have, we would have, but you'll regret it. Not taking out an ad. And then suddenly, then that issue came out, and then after that, they'd review, like, the Dead Kennedys or something at some place, and we'd open up, but not according to the reviews. We didn't play, and we weren't even listening. I mean, so they, again, it's like it came and went pretty quickly. I mean, like, I feel kind of bad for, like, bands like Gangrene and stuff, who were kind of caught in the middle of it. Who didn't want to speak out against, because, I mean, it shouldn't have ended up that way. But, again, they had the SSD were carving out their niche, and you got to give them some props for that. They stuck to exactly what they said they were going to do. Al, me and Al talk now and then, and get along pretty good now. We both have the same anti-Trump thing going on, and
Was it
not
the
not to go
Boston
there, but what's that?
was it the Boston crew in general that you were having issues with?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean they
I
would
mean, it
come
was
to
just.
shows like some of those guys. I don't even know who the fuck they were, but they were. I think they were in that camp, and they would like blindside Cliff. We were playing at the Channel one time, I think with the Misfits or something. It was that big awesome show with the Misfits in '83, and some guy was coming up from the backstage, the stairs, and then he would ram Cliff, you know, from behind. You know, Cliff was singing, the guy would nail him from behind, dive into the pit, come around, and he did that like two or three times. One other time we were playing down at Mavericks, and I think it was might have been Jake or one of those guys, rest in peace, that came up and just like sucker punched Cliff right in the face, you know.
Wow.
You know, just playing a show. So I don't know, you know, that was some screwy stuff. But on the other hand, we had people that loved us. And it seemed like there was more of those people than there was just a little handful of those sucker punch hit you from behind guys, which thinking back, it was like, who are these assholes? You know? But anyways, what was the last question? The
Well,
scene?
the point, the funny part about it is, like I said, all of these bands compliment you guys. In fact, I was curious, and I'm going to jump ahead now. I don't like to do that, but I'm going to. Why you guys weren't invited to play the Hardcore Reunion show? Because when you look at the bands from that era, to me, it's, Gangrene, Jerry's Kids, SSD, DYS, and the Freeze. So I'm
We
like,
probably were. We just didn't have the means. I mean, we got guys spread out all over the place, not really a functioning lineup at all times. It's not like, hey, we got a gig, let's go play. It's like we got to pull it together, you know? We got to fly, we got to rehearse.
that was 2010, I think. So you're
Yeah.
saying you probably, so you, they did ask you to play?
Pretty sure, yeah, we could have played that show. I just didn't think we were able to logistically pull it together. Because it's, you know, we've got like a million people have been in the stable of this band, like shitload of bass players, you know. But now, I don't know. I mean,
Wikipedia looks like the whole state of Iowa was in the freeze, man. If you look at the
yeah, I
list
know.
of
I think
I don't even know half these guys, you know. I mean,
there are at least there are 50 people, yeah,
wow.
that have been played with us.
You
God bless.
mentioned Walter earlier, and I saw his name on that list, but I didn't
Walter.
remember him being in the band. When was
Walter played on, let's
Crawling
see,
Blind?
Walter played on this record, early 90s, great album, Crawling Blind. It's
Oh
one of
yeah,
my
I get.
favorite ones. Yeah, that had me, Walter. I played bass and guitar on it. We had Joe Coons on guitar. And then Scott, the drummer who plays with us now, who is another guy from way back at the Mill Hill, he's even younger than me. He plays drums on one of the song and then went on to play on a bunch of the albums in the 90s.
I was going to ask you about that record because that was on Lost and Found, but it's my fault that we jumped ahead. So let me go back for
Yeah,
a
sure.
second here, because after This Is Boston, Not LA, and Guilty Face, and I'm not sure which came out first, but they were close to each other. They're both in not
Boston and LA
82.
was first.
Yeah, you guys put out the Land of the Lost record on Modern Method. To me, one of the best, most underrated records to come out of the Boston scene. And, of course, American Town had a lot to do with that because that song is brilliant. Do you remember g recording Land of the Lost? And talk about that a little bit, either one of you, and what that period was like.
Well, I could tell
Bill,
you.
go ahead because you were full time then at that point. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that was like I think the band, you know, we had lost the great bass player and Rick Andrews between Land of the Lost. I mean, between Guilty Face and Land of the Lost. But the band had gained Ron Cormier, great guitar player from the Cape, who actually I think he was in before me, but it was for a short amount of time. And then it became me and Ron were the strings section in the band. And we used to play half the set. I'd be half the set on guitar, half the set on bass, Ron half the set on bass, half the set on guitar, and would switch. So on the Land of the Lost album, I think Ron's probably 2 years older than me. So he's probably like 18 or something at the time. And I was like 15, 16, I think, when we did that record. And Lou was on drums, Cliff was on vocals. And I think Modern Method covered the bill for the studio. It was in Waltham, Brown Street Studio, big 2-inch tape place. Never seen it. I didn't know anything about recording. If we did, it would have sounded better, but it has that sound of that era. And where were we? Yeah, so we would drive up from the Cape and you know, did our basic tracks in a day like everybody did back then. And going back to Boston, LA for a second, I remember Lou was laying doing the basic tracks for Boston, LA. Was it nine songs? And he's got a bottle of Tango, right? It's a pre-mixed screwdriver. I was in the studio hanging around, and by the end of the set, he nailed everything in two takes or one take. He nailed it. He was drinking the Tango, laughing his ass off back there. He had a great time, and he nailed all the drums. So fast forward to Land of the Lost. So Lou nailed all his parts. And I think, I don't know, we went in to do overdubs once or something on guitars. It was the first time I heard doubled guitars left and right panned. And I was like, oh my God, it sounds like the Ramones, you know? And it was pretty exciting, you know, first album.
Yeah, that when I was in LA when that came out, and there was a buzz, man. There was definitely a buzz on that record without fantastic. And then shortly after that, you guys had the song on the Flip Side vinyl fanzine, Volume One. I don't think there was ever a
Professional.
Volume Two.
Oh,
Bill, Bill.
going back to Land of the Lost. What a lot of those songs were Cliff and Ron wrote those songs. Like Ron
Okay.
came up with a lot of the music, Cliff vocals, kind of the arrangement we have now with me and Cliff. I'll come up with music and Cliff will just like phrase the thing up beautifully with lyrics. And Ron was a huge part of the Freezers, sound at that time, and me and Ron used to play together all the time on our own,
Yeah.
so bounce guitar licks off each other and stuff and kind of like develop what was happening on that thing. But Ron was a little more matured in the guitar department than I was, so he brought a lot to the table, that guy.
Oh, he definitely did. I mean, because we had lost Rick Andrews, and Rick wanted to pull us more in the Guilty Face direction, specifically like the song Guilty Face. He wanted to play the fast kind of thing, and he wanted to have like a crass kind of attitude and stuff.
Discharge.
He discharge and stuff. Yeah, a little bit,
It's great, but that was
but
Rick's
just not.
darker. Rick was darker.
Yeah,
Or,
he was. Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
but
and
I don't
he
know,
just yeah.
burying your 5-foot-1 girlfriend and that song on that album is kind of dark too, I suppose.
That's in this. It's all symbolic. It's got to do with the memory. The garden is the memory. Anyway,
I didn't mean to jump ahead there, but I remembered that compilation and Bill Bartell, Gassatanka Records. I don't know, did he just contact you guys and say we want to put you on this Flipside compilation?
Oh, was
I
that
threw
who
that
did
out.
it? I think it was either Flipside Zine got in touch with us. It was on Gassatanka FU's label or
Through Enigma. I was working at Enigma. That's why I know
Through
about it. It
Enigma,
came
right?
out on
Okay, yeah.
Gassatanka Enigma Records, and No One Is Ever Coming Home, I think was the
Right,
song.
oh, that one. Oh, that's a different one. Oh,
Yeah, that's the
I'm
first
thinking of the
version
other
that.
compilation that what's his name did,
Oh,
Steve
Love
Perry.
Confessional, yeah.
Yeah, No One's Coming Home.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you were on Steve Barry's compilation. Well, listen, for as many members of you had in the band, you've had as many records here, so forgive me if I'm like
Well, it's the core of the guys, the recording guys has always remained the same.
Yeah.
The live show guys, that's like a different thing. Like, but the core of the recording lineup has always been like me, Cliff, and either Lou or Scott Walter on drums. I usually cover the bass stuff, as well, and Joey Coons on rhythm guitar. That has been like the core for the years span lots. I mean, the album span lots of years, but when it comes down to like the songwriting unit, it's like ma mainly like me and Cliff, we're the material guys. I think that's pretty accurate, from Rabid Reaction on or something.
That's where I was going
Yeah,
next. During
yeah,
that
yep.
period from like 80 to 85, you guys had a lot of stuff out. Rabid Reaction, Steve Cataldo
Yeah.
recorded that. The song Bloodlights, one of the great songs by the
That
Freeze.
goes up. That's a little later on. That's in 1990.
Oh, Bloodlights wasn't on Rabid Reaction?
Bloodlights is Mr.
No.
Love's Company. But
See what I mean?
Steve also produced Rabid Reaction in like 1985, I think, and that was recorded at Newberry Sound with what was his name? Mendelssohn there was the engineer. But anyways, we learned a lot from Steve about how to like
Yeah.
approach choruses, background vocals, little guitar flares and stuff.
Yeah,
You talk.
I got Misery Loves Company right out. That's how I got confused because Cataldo did both of those. John Hartcorn engineered some of those too,
Yep, that
right?
was so Rabid Reaction is when John came over at the Syntex studio, which is gone now, over on Boylston Street down by BCN, the baseball pub building.
1312 Boylston Street. I
It
know
was a
the building
great
well.
studio. Yeah, you know that place, Dave, and all those guys were down there. And
Yeah, Minahan started there too.
And then we went on to him. We recorded album over downstairs at his place. But anyways, Syntex, beautiful studio, 2-inch tape, nice rooms, ISO booths, the whole nine yards. And that was a really good experience because Steve would handle the budget, so they would eat up the budget spending a day on the snare drum, and we would sit around. When can we play on guitar? And
We don't
but
have any
anyways,
drummers here to defend themselves, okay?
but it's a fucking snare drum, But anyways, Hartcorn has great history and experience. So between him and Steve, they really They did us proud, man. That was our, we were starting to sound pretty good at that time, like sonically. The snare drum sounds great on that record.
And
Now,
you
which one?
stuck
On
with those
Misery Loves
Rabbit?
Company, I mean, on Rabbit
Oh, Misery.
Reaction. If you
Yeah, and
listen to
then
the
Modern
single.
Method, then Modern Method dissolves, and we dissolved along with it. That's pretty much what happened to us in the late 80s.
Yeah, then
We
we
got
got
the
the
Rabbit
German.
Reaction.
Then the German labels, that seems to be the course that things take in the hardcore and punk rock scene. Once your American support dies off, Europe picks up, and now you're back on top, only at 7,000 miles away.
Yeah, and if there's any bits to still be had, you get like the Vultures, like the other guy on the West Coast, San Diego, there that will swoop in and gobble up what's left.
Did Mike Dries call him the gangster across the street?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh boy. I
Nameless,
was
but
just gonna mention Tang Records, and you had to go and like just
Tang, what are you
destroy
talking about?
everything.
Nobody said
We weren't
anything.
talking about Tang Records. Why would we do that?
We
But
probably
anyway.
signed the contract and didn't read the thing, and that's why these like releases, i.e. bootlegs, show up on a slower speed and shit in Europe. All this stuff pops up all over the place. It's like, I don't remember that, and it's like, but
Again,
hey,
if you.
right? What the thing that I do say, it's great that someone has taken the energy to release stuff and get it out there, because otherwise it just wouldn't be there, So we didn't get the 30, 50 bucks over the 10 years of royalties. Big deal,
You
Wow.
know, it really, it's kids, and I hear what Bill's saying on that too, and I agree with it too. It's kept the name out there. It's kept the product out there, and it's kept the songs alive.
There's a lot of
So, I mean,
compilation
anyways.
records. There's a lot of freeze compilation records
So
out
a
there.
lot of re-releases too. I mean, these albums, I don't know, like they don't get the master tapes. Maybe Steve, when somebody does a re-release of, say, Land of the Lost, which has been re-released a bunch of times, what do they use for a master? Like, do they just record the CD or something? I
These
mean,
days you can do that,
it's just going
unfortunately.
to degrade the quality,
Yeah,
obviously.
these days you can do that, but yeah, I'm old school like you guys. I like I like tape. I was a tape. I always loved tape over analog, digital. But it's changed now, and people, someone could actually take your CD and replicate it and
Yeah, they're
re-release it.
basically bootlegs, like a low budget, like, okay, we'll re-release it, give you some money for it. But really, all they're doing is recording what's recorded and releasing it at a lower quality,
So you
lower
didn't
cost.
sign agreements with a lot of these people?
Well, I left Cliff was in charge of that. I was kind of hands off,
Well, the I guess the fortunate experience of, but it ended up not being so, with having Modern Method be the first label we signed with, because we were able to do what we should be able to do with people is just have a gentleman's agreement. Basically, they said that they would do this and that, and they did this and that, and they always lived up to what they promised us, and we always they gave us promos when we wanted, and just they were, and they still to this day they pay timely in timely fashion for the Boston or LA repressings they do and whatever. But I mean, and then we went from that to Curtis. And so, we went into Curtis kind of like, blinded by honesty in a way, into like, the vulture's nest.
Well,
And I remember.
the thing with that, it's like, it wasn't, reputationally speaking, it's like you kind of heard about what you could possibly be getting into from all the other
True,
bands.
true.
But
Yeah,
I
true.
like the guy. I like talking about music with him, But I don't, the business end of thing, it's not my bag, baby. But it would be nice to get a little mailbox, maybe a little BMI check once in a while.
Not from our songs, though.
Yeah, for other stuff.
Yeah, I just got my recent my BMI thing. It was $8.97.
Yeah.
Remember the first one I got was like $123.
Speaking of which, so going back to how Boston not LA is a kind of an anthem, when, you know, Boston is in a sports series with a Los Angeles team, they'll be playing that song. I don't know who's getting the money. Because it was that publishing piracy thing, I think, Cliff, you're talking about. Go find the low-hanging fruit. You know, look for the guys that didn't know any better. The stuff's dangling, ready for the taking.
I didn't want to bring up any bad memories with you guys about your publishing. I apologize for that. I think you guys have had a great career, and I think a lot of people respect you guys for everything you've done, and that's why maybe I wanted to have you.
Maybe the next record should be called Low Hanging Fruit, right? Suckers.
So I think the last thing you guys did here that's out on vinyl is Calling All Creatures, right? So have you played much in the last few? I know the pandemic happened and everything. There hasn't been a free show in a while, has there?
Not since that record, which was a good record as far as, you know, I think it came out really good. And if anybody wants to repress it, it's Low Hanging Fruit. Because I don't think it pressed the first batch, and then there was another kind of falling out or something that happened, and interest from the label was diminished.
I don't know Slope Records, so I can't say anything.
There you go. You're bringing names up again.
leave that to me.
Hey, I didn't mention.
I've got no problem with Slope. I love the guy and everything. There was just like some kind of domestic falling out or something that wasn't, you know, part of the things didn't go as planned. Again, there, I said it.
COVID happened too. That was COVID, a big part of it.
But that didn't help.
Pandemic put a wedge in that whole thing. But
we had another European tour planned, you know, set up, and we were ready to go over there with a new album, the first in 20 years, 20-year anniversary, I think, wasn't it? And then we find out that he only pressed 300 copies of the album, or 500 copies, and those had sold, so we had no new product to bring with us over there. And so that got to be a big, you know, and he sent nothing out to be reviewed or played on, you know, radio anywhere.
Yeah, so, just it didn't get a push, you know. He lost.
Didn't get a push at all. Yeah, his energy.
That's why I think it can be re-released and, you know, relaunched again.
Oh, hopefully we've signed we've basically agreed to a new deal with Bitscore Records. Bitscore, I don't know if you remember them. They put out the album with Billy on the cover, Double Dosed.
Oh, that one's right here. Let's see. I don't know if it's live or a compilation. Dennis McCarthy. You remember Dennis McCarthy, Steve?
I love Dennis McCarthy. That's his label?
No. He was working at Pat McGrath's place over there.
Yeah.
So he goes, I'm plucking through the records. This is back in the late 80s. I was playing with the Slaves. So me and Dennis were around each other. They used to call me Meathead sometimes. And he goes, yeah, the new albums came in, and I'm going through the records, and Meathead's on the cover of one of them.
Did you know you'd be on the cover?
No.
Oh, you didn't know?
They didn't have any more other pictures, I guess, because it doesn't really tell the story. I mean,
wasn't it Lunch Meat? You said Lunch Meat.
A lot of people, you know, Meatloaf, I don't know, you know, whatever, some bullshit like Meatloaf or Meathead or Lunch Meat, whatever.
I just wanted to bring this guy up because I like him, and I know you guys played with him, and he always mentions you guys. Craig Adams.
Oh, yeah. He's on this. Right. On
Freak
this
show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
He's a strong.
He's on One False Move, too, right? No, he's not, or is he?
Yeah.
No, is he's
he?
On that.
Yeah, he's on this and One False Move. And yep. We did this one over at, what's his name's place? The Outpost, Jim. Jim Siegel's place.
Stoughton?
Yeah, great. That is top notch, that place. But he's gone now. He closed it up. But a lot of good records. Sugar was recorded there. Bob Mould, Copper Blue was recorded there.
Oh, that's a great record.
A lot of that.
Excellent, yeah.
A lot of the Dropkick Murphys, kind of that whole scene took that place over for a few years. So, anyways, he's gone now. But yeah, Craig played on that. We used to practice at my house in Roslindale. This is me, Scott, and Craig, and Cliff. And this is the 90s. And Craig brought some solid musicianship into the fold. He could play all the bass lines and stuff. He's a kick-ass guitar player, but a kick-ass
Yeah.
bass player. He bounces back and forth really well. So he played bass on two of the later records where, the songwriting got a little more complex. We had like more parts and stuff, and we matured as players after 30 years or whatever it was,
Yeah, that's bound to happen when you guys were able to practice 4 nights a week or something, too. Like,
Yeah, we
and
practiced.
I'd come up for one, but
Yeah, I'd sort out the music with the guys, and then we'd have the songs pretty solid, and then Cliff would come up and sing to them. But he would be getting the tapes brought back down the Cape by Craig, so Cliff could listen to them and write the music, write the lyrics for him.
when did you move out to Arizona, Cliff?
Let's see, the nightmare began 2009, something like that.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, you mentioned that earlier, right?
I thought it was 1959.
Yeah. Arizona's only been a state for almost that long, haven't
You guys been in the same place recently at all?
they? Yeah,
Yeah.
I've been.
Who, us two? Yeah, the two of you. Jesus, when was the last time?
Physically, maybe
Well,
not mentally, but
he
physically.
came up like 6 months ago. We tracked some new songs because we were doing this Turbo Negro song, Self-Destructo Bust, for a Turbo Negro compilation on that Bitter
Nice.
Boy label. I think they released their first album or something. And so while we were under the hood, we were like, okay, well, let's do like three originals, So Cliff came up to sing on that stuff, which is still in the works. And then we've tracked another four songs, and we're going to try to get Cliff up probably over the next couple of months to LA.
So
Just
there's going to be a
we did
new
it. We did.
record soon.
There's all,
Oh,
yeah,
there,
there's
yeah.
new records worth of stuff just kind of by, having stuff hanging around,
Yeah,
It
Billy.
might
As
be
long as
sent
Billy,
Cliff. Go ahead.
as long as Billy comes up with catchy riffs and stuff that I can just immediately hear the lyrics to, why not write the song,
Yeah,
and
I've been sending him songs for, quite a few years now. Like, I'll get them done at home, at the home studio. And then I'll send him down the line to him. And then he works out, vocals and phrasing and lyrics. And then we just dial it in. We just start adjusting the arrangement a little bit. And then we have pretty good pre-production. And then we track him for real.
Yeah, our last drummer, Aaron, has just picked up on the engineering part of it, and he's been a big help with that too. So, we'll have what? We'll have half the album recorded by the next time I'm up there.
Yeah, we'll
I
have
mean,
like
well, the, after
seven
the
or
next
eight
time I'm up there.
songs or something like that,
Yeah, well, we have 12 to 14 that we could go with right now. I
That's
mean, they're going to have
fantastic. It will require some work. And again, it's logistics, He's down there, I'm up here. And as far as bringing the drummer in and all that stuff, guys are flying in from all over the place. But the beauty of it is that nowadays with recording, you can fly the tracks out to guys. And they can play on them, learn the song. So pre-production can be done remotely. But I, and then they can play with the stuff, the drums or whatever. And then when they come out, we'll spend a day, maybe two, in the room, rehearsing them with actual human beings, and then mic the place up and get it going.
Oh, Billy, I'm thinking, like I was going to mention to you that we want this album out by the time of the tour, or at least have the songs ready,
You guys have a tour booked.
Well, it's being booked,
We're
the
confirmed
European.
for this year's Rebellion Fest. Now,
Yeah.
the way I look at it, it could go either way. I'd love to play it. We got a little bit of logistics to put together. So we're working on we'll probably get like a mainland Europe thing going, Germany, Holland, some gigs, a short one, not like a 5 week thing, maybe like 2 weeks or something like that. And do a bunch of gig at the regular haunts in Germany, a couple of places in Holland. I don't know where, going over to Italy and stuff, that's when you start chewing up the clock, you know. So we'll probably do the German stuff or whatever. And then the last gig will be in the UK, maybe with some other gigs in the UK, and then fly home. Or
fantastic
Rebellion Fest and then go across and play Germany, you know.
I feel like I'm in a band meeting with you guys.
This is more functional.
Hey, more thanks.
Disciplined, right? Yeah.
Sounds easy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Hey, thanks a lot, you guys, man. I know I was all over the place trying to. You have a lot of recordings and I tried putting everything in chronological order, but I think I got a little messed up there in the middle.
You did as well as we do.
Pretty close, Steve. You did that. Pretty good.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
But, nailed it.
But thanks a lot, and I can't wait for another Freeze record, man. That'd be fantastic.
We'll send you the new stuff.
Tentatively titled 911 to Nowhere.
Yeah, 911 to Nowhere.
I like it.
And that's where we've arrived in the year 2024 almost.
Nowhere.
Who knew we would get this far, right?
Yep, it took us that long to get this far.
Hey, thanks a lot, you guys.
Maybe that's going to be underneath it, underneath the title.
Yeah, right, Ray. Hey, Steve, nice talking to you again.
Thanks guys. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, so if people, are we off air yet? Oh, you can
no. Go ahead.
Are we still live? Are we still
live? Be careful.
So when can we see this, like on YouTube and stuff?
Oh, I'll tell you that when we get off, man. Thanks a lot, guys.
Night. Have a good one.
Yeah, we took you all the way back with the classic Time Bomb / This Is Boston, Not L.A. from the legendary compilation This Is Boston, Not L.A., which came out in 1982 on Modern Method Records, which was the label that was run by the fine folks at Newbury Comics. Conversation with Cliff and Bill was a real eye-opener in many ways, and I really enjoyed it in many other ways. I enjoyed the whole thing, really. I was just surprised to hear some of the things that they went through in the early days. But then again, like I mentioned earlier, not that surprised. Thanks, guys, for coming on. That was really great. You folks out there can reach me at any time at twistedrico@gmail.com. We have an Instagram page, Facebook threads, and a YouTube page where you can actually watch the interview I did with Cliff and Bill. And also, there's a TikTok page at Twisted Rico where you can watch clips from the show, etc. Lots of good stuff there. If you want to support this show, and we hope you do, check out our Patreon site over at patreon.com/TwistedRico. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.